From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
One thing that Ken Drews and I are certain about when it comes to plants, that they will often surprise you. Some grow bigger or stay smaller than the catalog promised, and some are better or worse behaved, or tougher or more tender than expected. Some plants that have surprised us over the years, for better or worse, is our subject today, but first this message.
Underwriting support from Color Blends, supplying top quality spring blooming Dutch flower bulbs to landscape professionals and ambitious home gardeners. More information on the web, colorblends.com.
Ken Drews, who gardens in New Jersey, is the author and photographer behind 20 garden books and a longtime friend who grows lots of plants that definitely surprise me. He's back today to talk about plants that in one way or another weren't quite what we expected, as in surprise. Hello, Ken. How are you?
Hi, Margaret. I'm waking up.
Good for you. Good, good. It's a good thing to do in the morning. So surprise, surprise. And we've been gardening a long time, each of us has. And it is interesting, you know, as much as sometimes we did our homework before we acquired something, and obviously sometimes we all impulse shop and so forth and don't do any homework. And that's always a surprise then what you bring home. But
it's always a surprise.
Yeah, but even with homework, it's like sometimes it's, you know, the plant tells you what it wants to be in your garden, right?
As opposed to what the catalog or, well, even some online sources. For example,
yes.
I have a Taxodium, which is a bald cypress, and it's supposed to be dwarf. Everything I read about it, dwarf. The best sources, including, I won't tell you the whole name, but the Conifer Society, said that it grows to 6 feet in 10 years and 2.5 feet wide.
Uh-huh.
And it's beautiful, but it's, I'd say, over 12 feet high and more than, you know, it's like 10 feet wide. So it just shows to go, yeah.
Well, that word dwarf is a great one to start with, because I think that's caused a lot of people a lot of surprises. People who have bought a dwarf, fill in the blank, often a conifer, but something that's dwarf or so labeled, and then stayed in the same garden for a long time, like not moved, you know, to a new place, mm-hmm. right? Or if you go to an arboretum that has a conifer collection and it's old, the dwarf conifers are not so dwarf, right? So it doesn't really
mean. I think it's kind of
means,
well, I think it means compact, maybe, because this tree is compact. You know,
right.
It's chubby.
Right. And they say it means slow growing.
Slower growing. Right.
Slower growing than the type, than the species that it derives from. So I have my biggest, where I learned about the dwarf wasn't small, wasn't synonymous with small, was I bought two dwarf white pines, the native Pinus strobus. They were Pinus strobus nana, the variety, mm-hmm. which just means, I think, small or dwarf. And you know, a long time ago, decades ago, and they are now, they're big. They're 10 feet tall and 15 feet wide or whatever.
But they're not 100 feet tall.
Correct. So they're nothing like Pinus strobus in the sense that that would be a giant tree. But they're still nana, but they're not small, right?
Well, that's a good thing to think about, because you said when you go to an old collection, but if you're in the nursery and you see these little
buns, right, scones. Ooh, I'm hungry.
Ooh, a chamaecyparis scone. I love that.
Yeah, and it's true. They look like they're going to stay tight and compact like that all the time, but they don't. I mean, I know, and we're generalizing. Obviously, there are some plants that stay very small.
Sometimes
very long
they
time.
Say miniature. You know, sometimes
right.
there's an extra word.
Right.
When I looked up Peave Minaret, it said it grows 4 inches a year. Well, I'd say 12 inches a year.
Right.
But maybe the people who, maybe the people who introduced it hadn't really grown it long enough.
Well, I think that's the thing with, and so you're talking about a bald cypress. I've never grown a bald cypress, first of all, and you know, it's probably not in everybody's garden. And this is a particular cultivar of a bald cypress. So we're talking about something that's not produced in the hundreds of thousands of units a year and shipped to every garden center in America, probably, right? It's more of a specialty item. And I think when you do that, you don't have as much data, right, about how it's going to perform and in different regions and, you know what I mean, different conditions.
And moisture.
Yeah. Like that, right? Yeah. So the information about it that, you know, I like to look on like the Missouri Botanical Garden Plant Finder site and, you know, a few other reference sites like that, and see what is generally thought to be the range and size and so forth of things. And in books, but most of my books are older, and in catalogs. And it's, you know, if they didn't have data from a million gardens, you know what I mean?
Well, Peave Minaret, this particular one I keep talking about, was I checked when it was introduced, and it really hasn't been around that long.
Right.
So I should tell the Missouri Botanical Garden, for example, that it's taller than they thought. Because that's one of the sources.
Right. And so something that's not rated as a dwarf or anything like that, but similarly that the books and the websites say it gets to 8 to 15 feet high and wide, is Aeschylus parviflora, one of my favorite herbaceous shrubs.
That's like parking a school bus in your yard.
Bottle brush buckeye. And it does. It gets to that. And then it becomes a colony because it's something that kind of suckers, kind of, you know, colonizes underground and expands its territory sideways. And I have five of them. They're very large plants.
Gosh.
And let's see, 4. Four of them. And one is 30 feet across its territory now, right? Because it's been going a long time. And so in truth, the one plant, if we could find that original stem, so to speak, you know what I mean? The original material that was the first plant in the middle of the colony. Maybe that, do you know what I mean? It's now, but now it's like this enormous, enormous group of connected underground connections.
Well, you have space for that giant plant, but listening to what you're saying, I'm thinking about plants that if you plant and you don't have the space, become what we call, you know, invasive plants, something that's too lusty.
Right, right. So that's, oh boy, now you're going to get us started on ground covers, quote unquote, huh?
I was in a garden in Vermont, a garden of some people who are really expert, and there's this really cute ground cover, very short, and it had little yellow flowers and it had beautiful foliage. And the owners of the garden swore that it was not invasive. It was a wonderful, delicate plant. And they gave me just a little bit. I will never be rid of this plant in my lifetime ever.
Right.
Impossible. Right. And even if you try to spray it with something like vinegar or something, the leaves are repellent.
Oh, and that's really why the definition of weed isn't universal, but is wrong plant in the wrong place, right? Because in their Vermont garden, something kept it in check, that it was an acceptable level of performance and vigor. And in your garden, it's out of control. Is it because it's a zone and a half warmer? Is it because blah, 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 blah? Who knows what, right?
Well, you said the word weed, and what came to mind was a plant that was on this property when I came here, which is gout weed. How about that one?
Yeah, that's one that I think we all inherited. Right.
And it's still sold.
Right. Especially the variegated one, right?
Right. But I saw an ad for the green one recently. And
that's
if
insane.
You have that, you will never, ever be rid of it, no matter what.
Yeah, it's insane. So size is one thing. And so related to size, you know, and sort of the dwarf thing being one like, huh? Surprise kind of thing, because the dwarf wasn't dwarf anymore. Some things even that I planted at the same time, even that were all conifers within the same, you know, within a couple of years of each other that I planted them, some grew so fast. The rate of growth can be so insane, like metasequoias, the dawn redwoods.
Oh, for you too? I thought it was because they reached the underground water source or something here.
So you had the same experience. And I think they're known to be very fast growing. And it will say that in the books.
And then they stop, you know, they get to a certain height and then they get wide.
but it's like when they talk about fast, they really mean fast, like unbelievable how that tree grows. And then the other surprise about that one is that even though it's gigantic, it has the tiniest little female cones. The seed cones are the tiniest, most beautiful little things, you know? So a funny juxtaposition against such a big, mighty, fast-growing, vigorous tree is these delicate little creatures.
Beautiful tree. And it gets these, what are like fissures? What would you call the way that, you know, the trunk is?
Yeah.
And the deep ridges. Oh, it's so beautiful.
Yeah, really a wonderful, so the dawn redwood, a deciduous conifer, another distinction in them about it. And contrast that rate-wise, growth rate-wise, against my oldest plant, the plant that I brought here from the garden I had made for a few years before I came here to this place, probably 35 years ago. So I'd had it, I dug it out, I had it a few years, I dug it up and I put it in the moving van, which is a Japanese umbrella pine or Cyadopitus verticillata. And that does say in the books, very slow rate of growth, like 6 inches a year or less or whatever. And it really is true. And it's not until 20 or 30 years that it starts to grow. It seems like it gets fuller and grows a little more rapidly or whatever, really.
I remember one of the years ago, that plant still is. You don't see it very often. It's in a way it's rare. And I saw it on Long Island Zone 7, and I was told that it was a Zone 7 plant. And it wasn't until you told me you grew it up there in Zone 5 that it's a hardy, hardy plant. I think that's one reason that people don't grow it. Also, I guess deer eat it too. I don't know.
I have a fence, but in the years that I didn't have a fence, I never had any deer moments with it. But it's very close to the house, and that may be why. You know, I don't really know. So speaking of, then you sort of mentioned hardiness, and that's another thing that, you know, if we're smart, we look up in the book before we purchase something, especially a tree or a shrub that's going to get big. And we're going to have a long time and it's going to cost a lot of money relative to, say, an annual. We look up not just the size, but also the hardiness. And that's another one where maybe these lesser grown, less popular, where there's less information about them.
Or some salespeople who are eager to stretch the zone limits to sell the product. They sometimes warn you, you know.
Right.
Someone we know.
Yeah. So I had an interesting correspondence the other day with a scientist from the Arnold Arboretum in Massachusetts, which is, you know, this incredible world-class collection of woody plants, and Dr. Michael Dosman. And I was asking him about something about hardiness and, you know, why is it in all the books different, just what we're talking about. And he said, remember, not all individuals within a species are created equal, and that provenance, where it came from, where was the mother plant that gave you the seed or whatever, really comes into play, particularly, he said, with cold hardiness. So, and he used the example of red maples sourced from the panhandle of Florida, where there are red maples, are far less cold hardy than those sourced from Minnesota. Same plant, genetically, right? But the individual, right? So, you know, that's the other thing. And when we're buying a plant from the nursery, we don't really know where it came from. You know, they got it from a wholesaler who got it from a. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Where's the original genetics from? So that's the other unknown factor, which I thought was really wonderful of him to remind me, because I guess I kind of knew it, but I didn't really think of it at all as one of the factors.
Yeah, I've read studies about the red maple.
Yeah, so that would say that the umbrella pine also, you know, in certain parts in its range, you know, there's certain elevation changes and whatever. There might be some that are a little harder than others, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, a lot going on, a lot of possibilities that would affect the accuracy of those guesstimates in all the books and websites, right?
You're making me think of hydrangea macrophylla, you know, the mop head hydrangeas. They're supposed to be hardy here, but I never get any flowers because my season is so short. This is my theory that the buds don't ripen because they're always blackened by the first killing frost. So it is hardy, but it doesn't flower. And so there's almost no reason to have it.
Right. So that's another surprise, but not of the positive one, which is that you read up to see if it was hardy for you, but that didn't mean it was going to perform.
Individual climate and here in a frost pocket, because I'm in a valley.
Right.
So you got to, I guess maybe I should pick plants that are for one zone colder or something.
Right.
But I learned something.
Right. Yeah. And I'm on a steep hillside, and that means that the warm air from below in the flatlands below me floats up across my property in cold spells. And therefore I'm a little, even though I'm higher, I'm a little, and it's not that I'm warmer. It's that it has good air movement, drainage, you know, air drainage in temperature extremes. So that's the opposite of what you're saying about your situation.
What are some surprises that turned out to be fabulous, like the Metis sequoia? Well, that wasn't really a surprise, but is there anything that you purchased or tried to do and turned out to be fabulous?
I suppose there are a lot of plants that, some that just haven't ever missed a beat. You know, I put a big purple copper beech up on the hill, dragged it up with two neighbors, dragged it.
Wow.
In a bone burlapped plant, dragged it all the way up the hill. We dug a hole and planted it. And it just has never missed a beat. And it's just this massive tree now. So, you know, sometimes you score, right?
Mm-hmm.
And things go right. And sometimes things go really wrong.
but don't see those things anymore.
No, but the what? So what? I don't know. Tell me one of your surprises that was like fabulous surprise.
Well, I thought, I was thinking while you were talking, you know, Corydalis lutea, which I think is weedy, but there's a Corydalis here that's Corydalis ochroleuca, and it has creamy white flowers that start blooming in May and last until November, herbaceous plant. And it has done that for over like 27 years.
Wow. Now, so Corydalis, for people who don't know it, it's in the group of plants called fumitories. It's related to the dicentras or the whatever they're called now, the bleeding hearts.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of delicate little foliage, a little moundy thing almost.
Right.
And textural like ferny foliage. And then little lovely little flowers. And the lutea one that you said, and I have that, which is still
everywhere.
Blooming here, still blooming here, which is... you know, yellow flowered. And the one you have, you said, is off-white kind of flowers?
Or? Right. And it's funny, I've never seen it in any garden except here.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah, it's funny how that happens. And I see the yellow one everywhere.
Right. Right. Yeah, I'm trying to think of other things that have like surprised me in the super positive way. One thing I guess is that, you know, in the old days, especially, I was zone 5A, and it was like, oh, you can't grow climbing roses. And, you know, because they're just too exposed. They're up there splayed, you know, out in the cold and getting wind whipped and whatever, and iced and so forth. And I found out about the Canadian Explorer series of roses. Do you remember those?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
So William Baffin, this rose, and it's this kind of like Pepto-Bismol or darker, actually pink and, you know, really, really intense pink. Wouldn't have been my first choice, but don't you know that plant's been with me for a million years? It really was not just hardy. It was like an endurance plant. So
that's interesting. I have the same experience with the Drift series of they call them landscape roses. They're from Canada too. And they're clean. The leaves don't have any disease. They bloom their heads off.
Right.
That's a good tip.
Right. So sometimes when you're told you can't, you have to dig deeper, right? You have to dig deeper and you find the right one that you can. And it's a surprise because it's such a steady performer when in fact, you know, the reputation of roses would have been, oh, no climbing roses for you, lady, kind of thing.
Well, you talked about your aeschylus. Talk about steady performers. What about your rhododendron?
That rhododendron was here. I have a big rhododendron. I don't even remember which one it is. It's an evergreen with purple flowers. It's massive. I mean, the damn thing is, I don't know, what is it, 20 something feet across, and I don't even know how tall, certainly 12 or more feet tall, 15. It was here when I got here, and it's twice as big as it was then. And, you know, it's a remnant of whoever was here years and years ago.
Do you have to spray it with pesticide?
I don't have to do anything to it. I don't spray anything with pesticide. Right. So it's a toughie. Right. Exactly. So you talked at the beginning, you talked a little bit about sort of like things that surprised us, either that they were a little too ambitious, like too lusty, let's say invasive. And, mm-hmm. and I mentioned the fact that back in the day, you know, the word ground cover seems to have turned out, surprise, to be a euphemism for a whole bunch of invasive plants. Some of our ground covers that they were most highly touted and still are sold the most in the biggest numbers, I think, are, well, you know, it was the classic ivies and vicas and whatever, Pachysandra, but also lots of others that were, you know, I mean, a lot of ground covers that turn out to be the thing that you're never going to be able to get rid of, right? Like, so that's tough. And then I was surprised to learn, I don't know, maybe 6-8, how many years ago, that one of the most popular viburnums, double file viburnum, that had been like the plant, is invasive. It's invading woods adjacent to where it lives. So it's a very prolific seeder. And, you know, I think in the Midwest and in the Northeast and so forth, it's become an invasive. So that's the other thing that's been sort of a surprise, is to find out that plants that were so highly recommended turn out to have backfired, right?
Right. You were talking about the ground covers, and I was thinking of the ground cover we always talk about, which is Geranium mycorrhizum.
Yes.
Which is so well behaved and so efficient and helpful.
Right.
So I guess there's a ground cover.
Right. So it fills the space that you need it to, but it doesn't seed around and make a mess and become this rhizome. The rhizomes don't, you know, go underground deep and impossible to remove. It's easy to.
And you can just pull it out
wherever
you don't want it if that happens.
Yeah.
Such a wonderful plant.
In the last couple of minutes, what other ones, you know, for any reason of surprise, what, when we talked to us the other day, we were first talking about this together on the phone. I was saying, like, one surprise for me has been the Japanese maples in containers and how many, you know,
grow them in zone 5 in containers.
What it would say in the rule book, right? But I do in big weatherproof pots, and I drag them into the garage in the winter, but they don't get any care while they're in there, and it's just as cold in there as it is outside. It's just not windy and icy. So that's one surprise that's been great. And some of them have been in those pots. I mean, I repot them every few years, but 15 years, some of them are that old. So that was good investment. What in the last minute or two, any that you want to?
Well, I grew a Clematis Betty Corning.
Oh.
And I think it's sterile because it blooms for over a month with little lavender colored bells. And it's herbaceous, mostly herbaceous. This last winter, it had a little bit of growth at the bottom. Grows up to about 4.5-5 feet tall every year, year after year. I don't do anything to it. And I don't have to deadhead it because, well, it doesn't set seed, but also it's herbaceous. So it goes right to the ground.
Right.
I just grab that and throw it out. And even though Hydrangea paniculata is such a cliche, you know, PG hydrangeas, but in the last 10 years they've come out with such amazing ones, and some people have given me some, but that plant, I don't have to do anything. Sometimes I cut them to 12 inches and in 2 years they're back to where they were,
right?
But they're so easy. It's like you could drive a truck over them, I think.
Well, and
they don't recommend that.
Right. And then speaking of a plant where there is a lot of data, because there are a lot of them out there and have been for a long time. So that's a plant where you're going to be told the size of this one versus that one versus the other cultivar.
That's true.
You know what I mean? That there's mm-hmm. because they're worked on commonly, there's a lot of breeding going on. There's a lot of numbers of those plants out there in a lot of regions. So I think those are ones where we have a lot more reliable information than some of these other examples that we've been giving.
I didn't know that calycanthus was going to become one of my favorite plants, even though I have to prune one of the biggest ones. But it's a great plant for the outer regions because you don't have to do anything to it. And it's fragrant, and the fragrance will float 30 feet from the plant when it's in bloom, and it blooms for a long time. That was a nice surprise.
So that's the sweet shrub. So that's a good one to end on, the sweet shrub. Beautiful native shrub, yes?
Yep, Carolina floridus.
Yeah, beautiful. So thank you for talking about some surprises. Now we could go on forever because I realize now that we've gotten going that there's a million of them, but that's enough for now. All right, go propagate something or prune something or whatever, okay? I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks.
Underwriting support from Color Blends, supplying top quality spring blooming Dutch flower bulbs to landscape professionals and ambitious home gardeners. More information on the web, colorblends.com.
And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you soon again, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening with some surprises in the meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.